We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. And this is ACAM Learn.
So, welcome to Mind the Kids. I'm Dr. Jane Gilmore, Honorary Consultant Clinical Psychologist and Child Development Programme Director at UCL.
And I'm Amita C, Professor of Psychology at the University of York, focusing on children and young people's mental health and special educational needs.
In each episode, we select a topic from the research literature and, in conversation with invited authors, sift through the data, dilemmas and debates to leave you with our takeaways. Today, we'll be discussing intimate partner violence and aggression and their effects on children. A note here, this paper focuses on lower levels of violence, and so we use phrases like minor or less severe. This phraseology, of course, does not imply that we consider them acceptable. In this episode, we ask, does minor aggression have a major impact?
So in the research that I've usually come across or even done myself, I'm interested in violence between children within the home, so sibling to sibling. That can be physical, emotional, etc., etc. But there are other types of domestic violence or violence within the home. So we can do child to child, parent to child to parent, maybe, and also parent to parent, so between the adults. And that can be, and that forms of violence, when it doesn't involve the child can either witness it or they might not witness it, but it's happening within the home. And I think that distinction is made in the literature about whether you see the violence or you don't.
And it is interesting about the witnessing, you know, being able to observe it, if you like, and being witness to it, but it's nonetheless happening around you and the effects are still apparent. I mean, I'm interested, Umar, but when you're saying, you know, let's think about the different participants, let's say, and observers with those contexts of violence happening in a family setup, if you like, because here we're thinking about young people witnessing a violence between parent figures, potentially. So it would be interesting to think about it in the context of attachment theory, because at its core, what we would be describing on person witnessing that violent interaction is a violation of that child's right to a safe place, a lack of security, and concern probably over their attachment figure. And we actually know that those young people witnessing violence at home are more likely to be described as insecure in terms of their attachment. Pascoe Fearn has done a really interesting systematic review that also shows a link between insecure attachment and subsequent externalizing behavior. So there's a lot of links there, but you can see why these domains of literature have an interaction. And I think the other thing to say from an attachment literature point of view is that if one attachment figure is experiencing violence from another, no matter how minor that might be, then those parents or parent figures can't be emotionally available to their child to moderate the stress of witnessing that moment. So there's a lot of attachment theory within that, which of course has relevance for the other individuals you were talking about. So for example, you know, a parent-to-parent violence or a young person experiencing violence from a sibling, but it's particularly relevant to the context of the paper that we're going to discuss today.
Yeah, so I hadn't thought of attachment theory when I was trying to read around this topic, but actually, yeah, you're right, it's actually very relevant. And when I've taught children and young people's mental health and behavioural difficulties, we do talk about attachment theory as one of the core theories which influences lots of later difficulties. And actually, it makes sense here as a mechanism through which intimate partner aggression then impacts upon later outcomes. But one of the things that I did want to just talk about before we get the guest in, which is when I was, I don't know if it's still the case, but when I did A-level psychology, one of the first things that you learn is the social learning theory of aggression. So, you know, you have this, I think it's the Bobo Doll experiment, Bandura, where the child sees some sort of aggression and then they test whether they've learned the aggression, etc. Is that still a predominant, but yeah, is that still like a dominant theory in the field of aggression? Or has, because I feel like a lot of social psychology that we learned 20 years ago has now like questioned and like reevaluated. Is that still a thing?
I mean, you know, the short answer is I'm the wrong person to ask, because we have an expert here to talk about that. But certainly if we consider that social learning theory, it certainly has high relevance for this data set, in part because there's a very strong link between this interpersonal violence or intimate partner and violence and externalizing behavior specifically. So that certainly supports the hypothesis that social learning is a key mechanism. But if we were to sort of pull apart the theory a little bit more, we would consider the importance of the model. So in the theory, we would predict that if a boy was witnessing male to female violence, they would be more likely to show higher levels of violent behavior than girls because they identify more closely with the violent model, if you like. But my understanding of the data is that there is conflicting data on this point. We're holding constant the idea that boys in general are more likely to show externalizing behavior. But there isn't a clear outcome here. And that might be something that we could raise a little bit with our expert to explore in more detail. I think the other thing to say is that there are other models that sit well with the social learning theory. You know, they're not necessarily competing models, but they may be augmented. So one example would be the cognitive contextual model. And that shows that the individual perception of a given behavior will influence the outcome. And that's Grinch and Fincham's data. And there's some model rather, and there's some interesting data to support that. So I think it's true to say that A-level psychology, it's the classic, right? It never goes out of fashion. But I think there's also ways of looking at that model as still being highly relevant, but thinking about some new data that will add nuance to it. Certainly, I think that's the case.
And I think that you've mentioned nuance here. One of the things that that we learn I think we learn it in A-level psychology as well, which is around, is it nature? Is it nurture? It probably is a combination of both. And, you know, and it would be reasonable here for me to suggest genetic propensities towards aggression. I think that there has been, I think that I'm aware of a genome-wide association study where we looked at genetic variants associated with externalizing behaviors. So I imagine an added nuance to what you've just said is that some children might have a higher genetic propensity towards aggression, which then manifests in a given environment. And that given environment might well be intimate partner aggression. Mm. If your parents are engaging in aggressive behavior and you see that behavior, or even if you don't see that behavior, that might be the environment in which your genetic propensity for aggression manifests.
And I think on that, I think that we know that there's some existing data looking at callous and unemotional traits, for example. So those young people who have those traits and witness violence are relatively more likely to show violent behavior in the future. But the mechanism of transmission here is debated. So in other words, is it an environmental experience, an observation? Are there genetic impacts? So I think you're right in putting a pin in that particular data set. I think that will be an area that will really add to our understanding of these processes. So I think it's a pertinent point to add. It's really useful to consider.
Let's introduce the guest.
We should.
Okay, so we're joined by Dr. Hedwig Eisenbart from Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand. Hedwig is the lead author of the paper, The Impact of Less Severe Intimate Partner Aggression on Child Conduct Problems, which is published in the JCPP Advances. Welcome, Hedwig.
Thank you so much for having me. This is amazing, and I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Thank you. So you've heard our little chat and our musings and hypotheses and what we think is going on. So based on what we've described in terms of our understanding of what intimate partner aggression is, can you tell us about what you mean by intimate partner aggression in the context of the conversation that we're going to have?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point to kind of define the space. And intimate partner violence is the word the concept has been used predominantly in the literature, also in terms of outcomes for those experiencing that. And that is usually oftentimes really related mainly to violence more literally, and that would be sexual harm or physical harm. Intimate partner aggression would encompass beyond that. So it encompasses both physical harm, sexual harm, but also what sometimes is called psychological harm. So anything that has to do with threats and that is not leading directly to a physical harm, but could potentially lead to something. So it would be shoving somebody around, would be shouting at each other, but also the threatened of showing any sort of violent behavior. And we used that concept in this current study because we wanted to be broad, but also like actually really look into what are the effects of something that is actually less severe, because people talk a lot about, and it's of course important to consider what happens when people experience the physical violence and the sexual harm. But we were also wondering what happens if that is actually not of that severe type, and how, what would be the outcome for children growing up in this kind of context.
That's so helpful. And I think highlighting the psychological message, if you like, around those actions, although in one level they are physical in their, you know, in their expression, actually what you're getting at is that the experience, the emotional experience or the emotional indication of how I respond to a partner or how I regard that partner may be of great import. That's a really useful definition. That's very helpful indeed. Can you outline a little bit, in broad terms, the links between IPA and child outcome?
Yeah. So what we found in this study, and that's based on the Growing Up in New Zealand data set, which is an amazing longitudinal study run outside of the area around Auckland in the North Island of New Zealand. And they follow up children who they have been recruiting basically through the mothers when they were still pregnant through the life. They are now about 16 years of age. And we selected a subsample of them, and the ones that where they had a reported partner at the time of pregnancy plus the first 9 months. And what we found there is that this intimate partner aggression that is reported by the mother during pregnancy and in the first, up until the first 9 months of the age of the child, had a positive impact in terms of it had led to an increase of child problems, conduct problems at a later age. So the child at age 4.5 and 8, while the partner reported intimate partner aggression, they get the same questions. And it's also not directional, those questions. That was linked only with conduct problems in the child in early childhood, so 2 years of age, but not later on.
Interesting. Yeah, there's a lot to think about. You know, one of the things that we were discussing earlier was, you know, taking a very broad view of what we know about the literature for in terms of other risks and protective factors. I mean, you've done extensive work on, for example, bullying in the broader sense. But Hedvig, I'm wondering if there is, you know, could you take us a tour around the literature about some other risk and protective factors that we might cue into, you know, thinking potentially about mental health and parental style and so on?
Can I supplement that question?
Yes, you can.
A slight bit to it, which is, to what extent is the measure of intimate partner aggression just a proxy for the rest of the home environment? Like, as in, like, is what you're measuring intimate partner aggression, but actually it's just telling us a lot about what's happening in that home in general.
Yeah, I think this is a really good point. I mean, apart from that, we always need to stick with what these data and results are based on. So basically, this is mothers during pregnancy reporting on how they're interacting with their partner and the partner the same. And this might definitely only reflect a broader picture of a context that they are living in. And so the strain that they experience that might be reflected then in intimate partner aggression might come from different other sources. So there might be financial strains, there might be health strains, there might be other issues that people are facing that actually look then, or that they also are apparent in this intimate partner aggression that they report. So I do also think that we cannot never say like this is in isolation, only one thing that we're measuring there. And this brings us to the other risk and protective factors. We know a lot more about risk factors, unfortunately, and risk factors and protective factors are not only like the absence of risk factors, right? So, but the risk factors that we know about for conduct problems, or as you mentioned earlier, oftentimes it's referred to as externalizing behavior in young people, are related, a lot related to parenting behavior. There is a little bit of genetics involved, as Umar, you pointed out earlier, but parenting behavior in terms of harsh parenting, inconsistent parenting, and the lack of warmth, maternal warmth specifically. And other variables are then linked to the person themselves. So things like cognitive abilities, there are most likely not driven by this context, but potentially also more genetically driven. And So these kind of factors play a strong role for the outcome. Plus, there might be some biologically driven factors. And so this brings us back to the question of how do we think, what is the mechanism? Why is that observing or being in the context? Because we don't know if the children were present when this happened, what the mothers reported and the partners. And actually, it's quite interesting that it seems to not matter hugely. The children don't need to be in the same room. It's the context again. And that's why it kind of seems to be almost like a proxy measure of that context that they grow up in. Plus, the first part of the data set, this were pregnant mothers. I mean, you could say, well, there's some voice that you can hear. You can hear a raised voice. You can hear, but there is something going on in the mother that is potentially linked to stress. So this, in this moment of experiencing that aggression, not only them experiencing themselves, but also them being aggressive. Again, we don't actually know because it can be both ways. And that's also quite important. So there is something going on that creates a state that will have an impact. And we do know that, for example, also components within the mother in terms of traits and low, like stress reactivity, for example, will have an impact on later externalizing. So all of these variables are definitely part of that. And that's also why we brought them into our analyses. And we thought we need to look at also, for example, mental health of the mother and the context that, again, part of the bigger context. And this could be mental health problems in the mother or the partner which arise from the intimate partner aggression. They can be independent of that. They can be there before the intimate partner aggression happens. And so for that reason, that was really important for us to incorporate that as a potential mediator in this analysis. And that's where we need this longitudinal kind of studies where we can actually look into this at different time points and to discern what is first and what comes later. So to control for all these variables over time.
So I want to just unpack something where you, in your paper, you talk about less severe or not as severe intimate partner aggression. And then you discuss that in the introduction where you give some context. Now, I would hypothesize, and this is not what you tested, but I just want your view on this. I would hypothesize that no aggression is associated with the best outcomes. The most severe aggression is associated with the least favorable outcomes. And then there's like a gradient in between. So you focused on the less severe aggression and you found that those children fared worse than those with no aggression. But is it just a quantitative thing, as in the more severe, would you hypothesize that the more severe the aggression, the worse the outcomes would be? And what you're demonstrating here is that even at the lower end of the severity, it does still have an adverse effect.
So you're talking about a dose response curve, basically. So the more, the worse. Yeah. We couldn't tell from our data set. So because we don't know the severe types, that's one of the things with longitudinal data sets. Sometimes that it's hard to ask these questions, and thus these specific questions haven't been asked. So we cannot really control for the severe forms. And so we wouldn't know. And I would be not inclined to like make assumptions. And I can just say like it has an impact. It has also an impact, but we can't compare it. And we need to keep that also because we're in a different context. So much of the research of this type has been happening in different cultural other contexts. So I wouldn't really say like, of course, that's the same just because the effect size is the same or something like that. So I wouldn't want to do that.
And I appreciate, and as an expert ever would say, I'm not prepared to make assumptions. This is an empirical question. I also wonder if there might not simply be, we don't know the question about dose effect, but would sort of coming back to these competing theories or complementary theories we were discussing at the beginning, would there be individual differences, whether that's the age of the child? You know, if I'm in my teenage brain phase of life, my brain is particularly receptive to environmental experiences. Might the experience of witnessing or that aggression being around me have potentially greater impact than potentially at another stage of my development? Or, you know, are there genetic vulnerabilities in the way I process information that mean I experience that at a greater intensity, holding constant the degree of severity of the violence? I think, and I totally applaud your caution in making assumptions, but it's a very interesting set of hypotheses to explore as another step. And your data set is so valuable in just raising the question, you know, that less severe forms of aggression have significant impact. So let's think about why.
Yeah, I just want to like also link in this. I'm very grateful that I'm able to work with the data set, which is collected by a set of researchers that I'm just associated with. I'm also not like part of the owner. I don't own that data set, but I was really, really lucky to be able to work with it. It is special. It will allow us to ask those questions, though, because I do agree that this is really, will be really important to look into what happens over time and when does it matter most or more or less. And coming back to your initial ideas or thoughts around the theories that might play a role here, and I do strongly think that attachment theory is definitely one theory that we need to think of. And we do know that retrospectively, so when we ask adult people about their attachment experiences, and it can be debated if that's the right way to do this research, that there's a strong link, yeah, between attachment and externalizing in adult people. And so this is definitely playing a role. On the other hand side, and talking about the biological underpinnings, some of these traits or some of the behaviors are set or are put in motion early, really early on. And then there is an interplay of different variables that make it like also protective variables. And we need to understand those better, that might actually be reducing the chances that they are getting carried out, or as it's called, like they're sleeping or something like that. And we do know from some nice longitudinal work in other parts of the world that some children would show behavioral problems. They would show also these colors and emotional traits that you were referring to, but then they don't show that later on. They fade. And there, some things are there that can contribute to that. And so when we come back to this protective idea, some sort of parenting and parenting help might help, might be actually be quite helpful, but it's never going to be the only thing. There might be different other variables as well. So I don't think we fully understand that yet. At least I think so. But it will be really, really key to discern a little bit. I mean, we always want to reduce harm and this intimate partner aggression anyways. It's not good for any of the three of the parties, right? So there's a no-brainer to just say like, let's reduce it. But as you point out, one of the time points in the development where it's much more important to really make sure that the child has protection, that will be quite key. And just out of like from a police point of view, from really the prosecutor's point of view, what they say oftentimes is that this is forgotten. So they show up at the doorstep when they get a call for domestic violence, and they take care of whatever's happening there. And it's forgotten that there's this child sitting in another room in the corner. And that's the thing that I think, even like, this is the probably severe cases that get where the call happens. But this is where we need to get better with taking care of that super early, much earlier than we think, much earlier before we think that they can observe and see that and copy that behavior. That would be like the, you know, the social learning theory type of.
So the messaging modeling is not simply to the parents in terms of understanding that, or indeed to practitioners, but also other agencies that are involved in child protection and safeguarding. I think that's a really important point.
Can I make an observation and then ask a question? I'm going to go ahead and hypothesize about like the developmental stage. So when in our work with sibling bullying, we find that sibling bullying, so violence between children in the home, decreases as they go into adolescence and as they grow older. And we explain that in terms of as children become adolescents, they spend more time away from the home. So they navigate towards friendships and peers and spend less time at home. So there's less opportunity for bullying between siblings. I would say that what you'd probably expect is that the effect of intimate partner aggression on the child is less severe in adolescence because they navigate away from the home. So like, even though there's a heightened time, I would think that maybe just because they're spending less time at home, the influence on their outcomes is less. So I would say it might be less of a problem, but still a problem. The other thing that I was going to ask you, was, we've talked a lot about intimate partner aggression, and I know that there's been a change in society in the last 10, 20 years in terms of violence against women and girls. And I suppose there's lots of questions here. So when we're talking about intimate partner aggression in the context of your study, do we have any indication of whether it's male to female? So is it from mom to dad predominantly, or do we have no indication of that? And then in terms of intimate partner aggression, how have these trends changed over the last decade or two? Like, is it more of a problem now? Is it less of a problem now? Do we not know?
Great question. So we don't know in our data set which direction, which in some ways is sad, but also I think it's probably quite protective for the two of them answering the question. And for that reason, I think there's a little bit of like, oh, that's actually might be a good thing in this kind of context of asking people who are in a longitudinal study those questions. So we wouldn't know from our data set, and we just know it's between them. From the research side of view, there was a predominant focus on women and like being as the mothers being affected most times. And so the woman, if you want to stay gendered, being the perpetrator is actually something that has been considered only more recent, like sometime as well. But this has been, and it's been definitely also much more underreported by men to be subject to violence and aggression in the relationship than women would underreport. So there's underreporting overall, but the underreporting is even stronger for men, no matter in which type of relationship they are. And so that's has strong impact on all the stats that we look at, really. And also we do know that there are cultural differences in reporting and help seeking for that type of experience. And so again, that's something that's just some in the mix that we need to kind of consider. That so it matters, how was that research done? How have people been asked? Where was it completely anonymous? Did they show up somewhere? Were they asked on the phone? This kind of really is, I think, not easy to discern, really. I cannot speak to the development over time. The prevalence is high, if you want to say so. If like across the globe, if you look at the WHO statistics, for example, that they put together, it's a lifetime experience of prevalence of 24% approximately. Mm-hmm. Past year prevalence of 4%. And there are some countries that go way beyond that and other countries that go way below that. It varies quite a lot across the globe as well. But we need to consider it high. In Europe, I think there was a paper that looked at specifically European countries. And that lifetime prevalence was, I think, 48%. So really, really high. And I think that... there's some reflection. It's always this difficulty of there's a reflection of more reporting, more acknowledgement of this is what I experienced. This is what this means when I experience that compared to the past. And then potentially, so that kind of is difficult then to discern, I would say, and I don't know about research. There might be great research out there that actually looks at that to discern if that's a reporting thing or if that's something to do with actually changes to the way that it's addressed publicly and people do seek more help.
I think I'm struck by two things. One is the potential cohort effect, depending on, you know, the acceptability of coming forward. And the other is that cultural shift. And I'm just thinking that, you know, New Zealand is home to two very valuable longitudinal data sets. And it's such a, and presumably, I think the Dunedin study certainly was selected, the community was selected because they weren't transient, they were likely to stay where they are, and it's easier to catch up, you know, in the various waves of data collection. And so those specific cultural differences in reporting or acceptability of, you know, particular behaviours and so on will be very important if we are extrapolating on two occasions from the New Zealand communities, partly because of some of the cultural differences that make them specifically such a valuable community, you know, to measure time over time period. So I think, you know, there are many moving parts in these equations, not least the cultural cohort effect.
Yeah. The nice thing actually about New Zealand, in addition, well, there's more longitudinal data sets. It's just amazing. But that actually also there are different cultural groups within that. So we could even, when we can, potentially look at different cultural subgroups within the data set, which are reflecting very, very different ways of approaching violence, reporting, talking about things that happened in the family. And so that's something we could look at. But I fully agree that because people bring up the cultural differences a lot from like also a religious point of view. And then there are some religious contexts in which, so that's not necessarily the country necessarily, but then the religious context that relates to the reporting behavior and help-seeking behavior as well.
Can we speculate and hypothesize some more? So I wonder whether child outcomes differ depending on who the perpetrator of the violence is. Mm. So if the violence is from male to female, I imagine that would have a different impact on behavioral outcomes or children's outcomes in general than if the violence is from female to male. So if it's mom to dad versus dad to mom. And I think it's partly because I would guess that the context in which violence would happen from dad to mom would be very different. Like it might be a certain type of home or community or culture or setup or whatever, where that setup would be different if the violence was happening the other way. Because I think violence from male to female, would that not be? Am I wrong there?
Yeah. Well, I strongly think we don't know, really. I think we underestimate what's happening in the homes. Mm. Okay. I really think so. And not only in the homes, but in relationships. And clearly, this is just our stereotype, right? This is our stereotype as well in our, like, however we grew up in whatever, like, if we say, like, Western context. So for me, it's clear that if there's violence in the relationship, it needs to be the man perpetrating violence toward the woman. It might still be a dominant thing to happen. That might be true, but I don't think it's that strongly shifted. And I'm not sure, and I wouldn't know any data that would have like a comparison for cultural differences in that sense, if that happens more in some cultural contexts, the main being the victim, basically, than in other contexts. Would be super interesting to look at. I fully agree, because I think that would be super, super interesting. The only thing I can think of that goes into this direction is if you were to look at reports of self-perpetrated externalizing of the mother and the father, and there's a data set that I'm thinking of, that's why I'm saying it this way, and then the outcome in the offspring, you could, and both, like, and you know, the gender of the offspring, you could look at into that. And I have this vague memory of that one data set that I'm thinking of, that so I think the overall, there were some nuances to that, yes, but again, this externalizing is not necessarily the perpetrated against, like, within the relationship, so it's not close enough to what you're looking for there.
I think what we need is either for someone to do this study, or if someone who's listening has done this study,
yes,
to be like, oh, this has been done, like, and this is what the finding is.
Yes.
You need to stop stereotyping assumptions.
Well, the only thing that remains for us to do while Hedvig is with us is to thank you so much for your time and your consideration and thoughtful interpretation of the data. Is, you know, in general, that's a really good model for us all if we're thinking about how to interpret data, and an indication of, you know, an expert takes an expert position with the confidence of knowing that I can interpret certain data sets, and there's some questions that remain unanswered. And that is a wonderful experience and lesson for us all. But thank you so much. We have appreciated your consideration, and we look forward to hearing what happens with the data in the next data set collection.
Thank you again. Yeah, that was fantastic.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure to speak with you and to discuss and hypothesize together.
Yes.
Let's unpack that. I just want to try and question my question of assumptions. Was the problem that I wasn't acknowledging the fact that female to male violence is a big thing as well? Was that the problem?
I think, well, this reminded me of the period of time where we were unaware as an academic community that, for example, there was sexual abuse perpetrated by women. And, you know, there was a period of time where it was assumed that various events were only the domain of a male perpetrator. And so I think what Hedvig was raising is that, you know, although we all come from assumptions, you know, it's inherent, you know, it's part of being a human being, is that the abhorrent nature or the anomaly of particular, you know, patterns of violence remains unexplored. Mm-hmm. I think the reason I said we can't say I feel like, it's my pet hate. You don't feel anything. You feel an emotion. You don't feel. So that's why.
I think my I feel like was like another way of saying my understanding of the situation
is that it's a young person's vernacular, Umar, and I'm too old to say, I feel like, but you are, so you have permission to use it.
I'm not that young, but yeah, maybe nobody has a permission. Yeah, that was really helpful. I think that it's nice because having these conversations gets us to challenge some of the concept.
Umar, I think you're particularly open to the idea of questioning something and responding to something. And I think that is the joy of being around somebody who has the capacity to observe, to question in a way that invites curiosity. So, you know, I love that question, and reflecting on it is such a positive experience. I think it's, you know, so valuable. It's very generous of you, is what I would say.
And so should we do our takeaways for us?
Yes. I just wanted to say two very quick things about the clinical implications, because I came across a really good review by Sean Koff, which is an overview of the literature looking at the long-term effects of being in a chronically stressful situation and the effects on the developing brain. Because I think Hedvig touched on some of these, you know, that hyper-aroused stress response system, which means that every time I walk into a stressful situation, I may react, my stress system overshoots, if you like. But there are also important impacts in terms of neurodevelopmental issues. So, for example, learning and memory and executive function are likely to be affected. Now, of course, executive function includes inhibition and emotional regulation. So if we think about those two functions in the context of expression of anger or conduct, they are particularly important for our discussion today. I think the second thing, just to say very briefly, is that there are evidence-based strategies for conduct disorder. And somewhat encouragingly, they are well placed to address some of the processes that we've discussed today. So depending on the age of the young person, parent training is indicated, cognitive reappraisal programs, so considering pro-social problem-solving strategies, and family therapy would be indicated. Now, all of those approaches will typically include psychoeducation about modelling behaviour, emotional regulation, consistency to parenting, and so on. They're highly relevant here, but perhaps our add-on for a clinical implication is that practitioners must underline the importance that any level of inappropriate or violent behaviour is likely to have an impact. And I think that additional messaging, you know, I'm using air quotes here, so if you're watching the video, you'll know that I'm air quoting, but minor aggression or little shoves in inverted commas will have a major impact. And that messaging will be important in all levels of conduct disorder support because it will augment the message. What about takeaways? Umar, what would you say your academic takeaway might be?
I think it's so we were having a discussion in earlier about the environment within which intimate partner aggression takes place. And it made me reflect on some work that we did where we looked at the perpetrators of sibling bullying, the kids doing the bullying, and the impact on their mental health years later. And what we find, I think, from what I remember, was that if you were not involved in any bullying, you had the best mental health. But then if you're involved in bullying as a perpetrator or a victim, as in someone's bullying you or you're doing the bullying, you had poor mental health. And, you know, it was a bit different, but actually you were disadvantaged either way. And a lot of our explanations for why the bullies have poor mental health were about the individual. So something about their characteristics or their personality or whatever. But actually, what I learned from this conversation is the reason why bullies might have poor mental health is because the context in which that bullying is happening and the impact that has on the communication and the interaction between different members of the family and the support that different members of the family can give each other, that support structure might then be broken down. And that might be why bullies also have poorer mental health compared to people who don't bully. So that's made me think differently about some of my own work and how we try and explain the finding that people who bully but aren't necessarily bullied themselves have poor mental health within the home.
And I think that's a really important point, which is generalizable to other areas of investigation. It's really, it's really useful. From a clinical point of view, I think the takeaways are clearly these data raise the important idea that the emotional context of physical actions or implied aggression may well be at the heart of harmful transactions. So in other words, it's the social and emotional messages that go alongside aggression that are particularly pernicious. And of course, the final point is psychoeducation for parents must include a discussion of the protective factors that may allow a young person to thrive in the context of stressful circumstances, but emphasising that witnessing violence at any level is likely to have a negative impact. So these small moments matter. They have a big impact.
Excellent. That's been a really nice conversation. Lots of data, lots of hypothesising, lots of questioning, which has been great.